to it. It's Thursday. It's the 17th day of October 2019. This is the Daily Daily Caller podcast, and I am your host, Derek Hunter. And I did that all in one breath. Welcome to the show. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing, telling a friend, spreading the word on social media and all that good stuff. We only grow because of you, and that's not a joke. That's all we got. Thanks to everybody who, if you have a second, write a review or just give some star reviews on iTunes. That stuff helps for some weird reason. I don't know. They do their charts the way the New York Times does their bestseller list. They don't tell anybody how you do it, but you can buy your way onto it. And I'm not buying my way onto anything. So when we get up there, I always appreciate it because that means you guys are telling people. And so thank you for that. We've got a busy, busy broadcast, narrowcast. It's narrow. You choose this. It's not. It's out to everybody, but you choose it. Show today, lots of audio, lots of action-packed stuff. The media is rallying to protect Elizabeth Warren. And it's amazing to watch journalists justify and call for bad journalism, demand bad journalism. It's shocking, but when you've got to circle, am I allowed to say circle the wagons when it comes to Elizabeth Warren? Is that racist because she claims to have been a Native American? Have been, being past tense? Or it doesn't matter. The media is circling the wagons around Elizabeth Warren because she's the front runner, and they recognize that Joe Biden is not really up to the task. Just a question of whether or not Joe Biden will realize whether or not he's up to the task. But we got that. We've got a ton of other things, as always. I'm going to be sitting down with Greg Jarrett today. Today's Thursday, so if you're listening Thursday evening, you've missed your window. But if you do have a question for Greg, email Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. And I can't promise that I'll get to it, but I do promise that I will try it. I will have it up on my computer. It's just a matter of how the conversation goes and whether or not it occurs to me. These things aren't scripted. It's all fly by the seat of your pants. And last time I talked to Greg, last year when he was on the show, it was just a great conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I don't think I would have remembered anything going into it during it. So we'll give it a shot. You'll at least infect my brain and maybe the topic will come up. So like I said, we got a lot of stuff. But first, a word from our wonderful, wonderful sponsors, all of whom you should patronize and do whatever it is they're asking you to do because they support this show. And I appreciate them as much as I appreciate you. Probably appreciate you a little bit more. Look, I'm a firm believer that when you're healthy, you're happy. That's why I use CBD oil from ancientlifeoil.com. I do. It's sitting right in a dresser in the next room. The mint chocolate. I keep getting the mint chocolate one because you stick with what you like. It's a natural remedy made with nothing but the purest ingredients and blended with coconut and hemp oils. I'm telling you, it's a home run hitter for your health. I was a skeptic. I really was. But now I see why it's so popular. I thought all those people were crazy. I feel great. Ancient Life Oil is non-psychoactive, meaning it provides you with all the benefits without the high. Sorry, stoners. I encourage you to do your own research. Just search CBD oil benefits for yourself, and you'll find out why tens of thousands and growing every day of your fellow Americans have made CBD oil a regular part of their healthy routine. If you're not living your best life, go to ancientlifeoil.com now, the trusted source for the highest quality CBD oil. Now, there's a lot of junk out there. That's ancient, A-N-C-I-E-N-T, lifeoil.com, all one word, ancientlifeoil.com. Use the promo code Derek at checkout, and you get free shipping. Boom, just like that. What have you got to lose, honestly? Okay, Elizabeth Warren. She had a lackluster. She was, well, I don't know that it was a lackluster debate for performance. She did fine. I'm still sort of trying to recover from watching 3 hours of debate. But the one moment that stuck out with everybody from the debate was the fact that she wouldn't answer whether or not she would raise taxes on the middle class to pay for her $30+ trillion health care plan, the Medicare for All, socialized medicine, government, complete takeover of health care. She won't do it. Well, people are going to have the savings. And as I went into yesterday, I don't need to rehash here. The only way you're going to see significant savings is right now if you have significant costs. I'm not talking about your premium costs. I'm talking about medical bills. then you will likely see some savings. If you don't have chronic conditions that cost you a fortune every year, you will pay more, probably significantly more. The government will come in and try and screw up and cut prices and control costs and implement price controls, and that'll just lead to another bigger disaster because government programs always balloon out of control. If I remember correctly, and I usually do, when I was a health policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation, I did a bunch of research because, well, that was the job, and I saw that the cost of Medicare, it was past 1965, and they, of course, had cost projections. And, oh, my God, it's going to be so affordable to do Medicare just for senior citizens and the disabled. Well, the Medicare costs after 5 years were actually what they were projected in the original projections to cost after 30. So that gives you an idea. Never really trust government cost estimates. I don't know that I've ever seen a government cost estimate that was under. You know, like, oh, wow, we thought it was going to cost $100 billion a year, and it turns out it was only $20 billion. What a wonderful thing, especially for an entitlement program or an expansion of an entitlement program. Well, anyway, to refresh your memory, I'll just play the little montage of people blasting Elizabeth Warren and her non-answer dodge on the question of how are you going to pay for this, which just seems like a pretty basic question any journalist should ask.
You have not specified how you're going to pay for the most expensive plan, Medicare for All. Will you raise taxes on the middle class to pay for it, yes or no?
So I have made clear what my principles are here, and that is costs will go up for the wealthy and for big corporations, and for hardworking middle-class families, costs will go down.
Well, we heard it tonight, a yes or no question that didn't get a yes or no answer. Look, this is why people here in the Midwest are so frustrated with Washington in general and Capitol Hill in particular. Your signature, Senator, is to have a plan for everything except this. No plan has been laid out to explain how a multi-trillion dollar hole in this Medicare for All plan that Senator Warren is putting forward is supposed to get filled in.
At the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of people will save money on their health care bills. But I do think it is appropriate to acknowledge that taxes will go up.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this and that taxes are going to go up. And I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but you have not said that, and I think we owe it to the American people to tell them where we're going to send the invoice.
And I don't understand why you believe the only way to deliver affordable coverage to everybody is to obliterate private plans, kicking 150 million Americans off of their insurance in 4 short years.
On the single most important thing facing the American public, I think it's awfully important to be straightforward with them. The plan is going to cost at least $30 trillion over 10 years. That is more on a yearly basis than the entire federal budget. And we talk about how we're going to pay for it. The study recently came out showing that, in fact, it will reduce cost. But for people making between $50,000 and $75,000 a year, their taxes are going to go up about $5,000.
So there, you're refreshed. You have the answers, the sort of, well, not really answer, the words that Elizabeth Warren said in response to the question of whether or not she'll raise taxes on the middle class, and her fellow Democratic candidates pouncing on the fact that she won't say whether or not she'll raise taxes on the middle class to pay for her health care dream. Just as an aside, she's going to raise your taxes. There you go. If you are an American citizen, you're going to pay more. That's it. Well, that exchange was very educational. It helped expose Elizabeth Warren as, yet again, she'd been down this road before, as unwilling to answer a direct, simple, basic question on an important issue. And it gave all of her fellow Democrats perfect fodder for saying, hey, look at this woman. She's not answering this question. And of course, she's going to raise your taxes. Well, that should have, I mean, it was probably the most important and useful for learning purposes for voters question and series of exchanges of the entire debate yesterday. that it exposed Elizabeth Warren as dodgy, as a typical politician, is what got some liberal pseudo-journalists upset. One of them was Jay Rosen. Jay Rosen is a professor of journalism at NYU, sadly enough. If you wonder where all these people come from, all these horrible journalists, where do they get these people? This is where they get these people, from people like Jay Rosen filling their brains. Jay Rosen has a Twitter account. He's very popular on Twitter. And he tweeted, quote, "The make Elizabeth Warren say she would raise taxes on the middle class question should be a credibility killer for the journalists who keep asking it." Essentially, he's saying don't ask that. Stop asking questions that will make Elizabeth Warren look bad. Larger than that, stop asking questions that could make Democrats look bad. Then you have a woman by the name of Margaret Sullivan. Margaret Sullivan is a columnist at the Washington Post. She used to be the public editor at the New York Times. I've talked about her before. She had a little think piece up there. You can tell they probably don't think much of her writing if she's in the style section. Her piece was entitled "Five Ways the Debate Could Have and Should Have Been Much Better." And it's full of the liberal crap. They didn't talk about voting rights and climate change. Like 3 weeks ago, they did 7 hours on climate change. I think that ground is covered. But no, that's not enough. There's never enough for the liberals. But number two in her list of five things, Margaret Sullivan writes the following. This is her number two point. Quote, "Framing the apparently unavoidable question about universal health care and how to fund it in a non-gotcha way." How do you frame, how is it a gotcha question? You've proposed X. How are you going to pay for X? Now that constitutes a gotcha question, according to the left. Sullivan continues, "Journalists are kindly doing President Trump's work for him when they insist on trying to pin down Senator Elizabeth Warren, the new frontrunner, to declare she'd raise taxes to fund Medicare for all. Of course, it's legitimate to." I love how it's like, oh, they're doing Trump's bidding. So getting information to voters is now doing Trump's bidding. See, the left is constantly redefining things and defining them down, twisting them around. They're finding ways to take existing words and existing realities and pervert them into a way that most benefits them. That's what they do. That's who they are. She writes, "Of course, it's legitimate to dig into the costs, but not in a way that creates a nice GOP campaign ad and misses the larger lens of overall costs." Parentheses, Warren notably refused to take the bait. So here is a so-called journalist at the Washington Post saying that asking Elizabeth Warren, how are you going to pay for that, is a gotcha question. It's doing Trump's bidding to ask somebody how you're going to pay for that, and are you going to raise taxes on the people you are promising the sun, the moon, and the stars to? That's now a gotcha question, and it's unfair, and it shouldn't be done. And she talks about here again, the last sentence, "Of course, it's legitimate to dig into the costs." Well, if it's legitimate to dig into the costs, then what the hell are you writing about, Margaret Sullivan? She continues, "but not in a way that creates a nice GOP campaign ad." Well, can Elizabeth Warren find a way to answer that question that doesn't fit into a nice GOP campaign ad? Can she? Can you do it, Margaret Sullivan? Is there a way to say, yes, I'm going to raise your taxes through the roof without somebody running against you saying, hey, wait a second, I'd kind of like to bring some light onto that subject. I'd like people to know about these sorts of things. Of course, there isn't. And she says, well, it misses the lens of overall costs. This, really quickly, I don't want to go off on a rant here, but the idea of overall costs, what they're talking about there is the trillions of dollars that are spent in the country on healthcare. Mostly, by the way, spent by government and private health insurance companies. Bernie likes to whine about those private health insurance companies. They made $100 million in profits last year. $100 million. So to stop the private insurance companies from making $100 million in profits, you're going to spend upwards of at least $3 trillion a year? Do you see the disconnect there? The overall costs, let's just use round numbers for the sake, and these are all hypothetical, so don't bother fact-checking me. They're conceptually right. Say you spend $10 trillion, this country does, on healthcare every year. $10 trillion. It's not that much, but just say you spend $10 trillion. And consumers spend, through premiums, deductibles, out-of-pocket costs, what have you, around $2 trillion. That means that somebody else is picking up the other $8 trillion, see? And that's the overall cost number that they're talking about. Well, if government were the sole provider of health insurance, of health care in this country, they say, it's not true, but they say they could get the cost down to, say, $5 trillion. We'll just use $5 trillion. We can cut the costs in half. Well, with with consumers paying $1 to $2 trillion now, and the costs overall to the country going down to $5 trillion from $10 trillion, consumers have to make up the additional $3 to $4 trillion. The private companies are gone. Now you're no longer paying insurance premiums. That money has to come from somewhere, because the government isn't bringing a stockpile of money that it makes in the casino business or making movies or anything like that. The government doesn't get money from anywhere except taking it from taxpayers. So maybe, and I don't concede that because it's never happened, if the overall costs went down, still the cost to consumers would have to go up necessarily, because as the government provides more benefits to people, they provide more benefits to more people for free. They would expand Medicaid, which the poor aren't paying for. We're already paying for. They're going to expand that to tens of millions more people. So even if the overall costs went down, the per person actually paying for it costs are going up, whereas you maybe spent $10,000 a year on insurance premiums for your family. Suddenly, you've got to pay your $10,000, and you got to pay a chunk of 5,000 other families' $10,000 who can't afford it. So while the overall cost to the country of healthcare, or the money that is spent in the country on healthcare, may go down, it won't, but playing their game, may go down, the individual cost for taxpayers, since so many Americans are exempt from paying taxes because they keep lowering the bars to where your minimum income is to have to begin to pay income taxes, goes up. See what I'm saying? The overall cost is less, but the number of people paying it is less as well. And you're no longer just paying for yourself. You got to chip in for everybody. So for Margaret Sullivan to sit there and go, well, you got to take larger overall costs into effect, I don't think the American people really care about the larger overall costs. I don't think the American people care what we as a country pay in total on healthcare. They care what their premiums are, what it costs them to go see a doctor, what it costs if they get sick. Those are things that they care about. They're not really promising that it's going to cost the individual family less. What Bernie Sanders skillfully and carefully says is you don't have to pay. It's not going to cost you anything out of pocket. You can go see a doctor, and the doctor just says, hey, thanks for being here. The government will pick up the check. Don't worry about it. Well, you're the government. You fund the government. The government has to get its money from somewhere. And if it's no consequence, no immediate consequence to go to the doctor, then people are going to be going to the doctor all the time. I got the sniffles. What the hell? I'll go to the doctor. It doesn't cost me anything. There's no incentive to see if maybe I'll feel better tomorrow. I'll just go to the doctor. What's the problem? Well, those costs have to be paid. And of course, American citizens are going to pay those costs. Taxpayers are going to pay those costs. And since there aren't enough filthy rich people out there for Elizabeth Warren's dream policy on top of all of her other dream policies where she's already going to tax the rich, the middle class is definitely, it's a necessity to raise taxes on the middle class. It'll be couched like Bernie is, but you're going to be paying less because you're not going to be paying any premiums. Well, really, you're paying premiums. It's just in the form of taxes to the government. And you're going to be paying more money in taxes to the government because you got to pick up the slack for other people. It's a complete screwed up system. But it's interesting to note that journalists and a god-awful journalist professor are now advocating that journalists stop asking Elizabeth Warren essentially tough questions that make her look bad. If you thought the bias that you saw in the media in 2016 and 2018 were something, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to get really, really ugly. On the plus side, though, on the other side of the scale is the fact that Democrats are absolutely crazy, and they will always form a circular firing squad. Frankenstein's monster always returns to the castle to destroy it. This story from Newsweek, it is... The headline, CNN moderators slammed for not asking questions on LGBTQ issues during fourth Democratic debate. You're like, is there every special interest group out there, every left-wing group sitting out there going, what, pay attention to me, pay attention to me? Yes, they are. They are a bunch of children. I just put my daughter to bed, the two-year-old. She is less selfish and less self-involved than any liberal interest group out there. Newsweek. CNN moderators didn't pose a single question about LGBTQ issues to the dozen presidential candidates on stage during Tuesday night's fourth Democratic debate, and advocates are not having it. It doesn't matter what advocates are having it. It happened. Issues facing the LGBTQ community, like workplace discrimination, have become a topic for national debate in recent weeks as the Supreme Court takes on several cases this term that could reshape gay rights in America. GLAD, an LGBTQ... Can we come up with a way to shorten this crap? An LGBTQ media advocacy organization continually tweeted updates about the debate that specifically noted the lack of questions on the topic. 2 hours into the Democratic debate, no LGBTQ specific questions yet. And then they did it again at 2.5 hours. Oh my God, what are they going to do? Last week, CNN did, 4 hours? 4 or 5 hours, specifically and explicitly on LGBTQ issues with all of these candidates. And, well, not all of them, but every one of them that wanted to be there that could be there. They all had their 40 minutes or half an hour, whatever the hell it was, to be asked stupid questions about very specific things. And, you know, this trans person came running down and grabbed the microphone and said, trans women are dying. You got to do something about this. What are you going to do? It was a feces show. But to say that they're ignoring these issues, I'm not one to defend Democrats and the media and CNN in particular, but give me a damn break. How much attention has to be paid? How many times do you have to answer these questions? Well, the answer is, of course, the same as it is with everything when it comes to the left. More. How much will it take to implement? What do you have to do to implement? More. Got to be more. How much do you want and raise? More. It's got to be always more. How much more attention has to be paid to this special? More. They are insane and insatiable. All they have to do is act sane to stand a chance. To stand a chance of winning, all any candidate or any party has to do is act sane or even semi-sane for stretches of time. You can have your moment, you know, you go out on the stage, you act sane for a while, and you go back in the green room and you just start screaming obscenities, rolling around on the floor, rubbing butter all over your naked body. As long as you do it in private, that's fine. In public, all you have to do is hold it together and act sane, and they are incapable of doing that for any length of time. You're not paying enough attention to me. Gay issues. Okay, they talked about the economy. Is that a gay issue? Do gays have a separate economy? Is there something going on there that we don't know about? Maybe. I don't know. I don't care. National security, they talked about that. Talked about it crazily, but they talked about it. Is there different gay national security? Should that have been covered? I mean, is there, there was one question about Hunter Biden and his corruption in Ukraine. Is there a gay version of that? If there is, I don't want to know about it. Just saying. I love to see these sorts of things because the left can't hold it together. If you really think about the left, they are a coalition of disparate groups who the left has spent years cultivating and driving into groups. We've gone from a melting pot to a series of chafing dishes. And the left has strategically, for their own purposes, stuffed every little group of people, every configuration of human being you can come up with, into these little petri dishes. And they tell that particular petri dish or that chafing dish, petri dish is something different, although maybe some of them are petri dishes. They tell that little chafing dish, don't worry, there's a force out here that's trying to get you. It's like the mist in that Stephen King movie, The Mist. It's trying to get you, but don't worry, we are here to protect you. We will protect you. You stay in your little container here. And we'll protect you from all the other containers that are full of evil people who are out to get you. And they tell that to all of these chafing dishes. And they move these pieces around the board and tap them and for money or for votes or activism or whatever as needed. But they are generally at odds with one another. Mostly because the Democratic Party has so often and for so long told them that others are out to get them, so stay hidden, keep your head down, we'll protect you. Well, for a national election, for a presidential election, you kind of have to bring people together. Not even really across the aisle. You have to be able to bring your coalition together. But their coalition has been told that through the power of intersectionality, that there's always somebody out to get you. And many of them are in the Democrats' own coalition. So they don't really have similar interests. If you are a member of the LGBTQ community, particularly a person of color, you get your own chafing dish. And you are told that you should only really identify with other LGBTQ people of color. But if you care to, you can expand your circle a little bit more, and it can be into the entire gay community or whatever. But you're also told that Whitey's out to get you, that Whitey hates your guts if you're a person of color, that the system is rigged to help Whitey, it was created by Whitey, and they're out to get you. Well, there are a lot of people in the greater LGBTQ community who are white. So are they gay first, and therefore you can identify with them, or are they white first, and therefore you should fear them? Well, after decades of having it beaten into your head that you've got to fear this one and avoid this one and only identify with this one, it's starting to crack. It's starting to fall apart to the point that the largest gay rights organization in the country will sit around after having a full night of cable television dedicated to gay issues, gay questions, questions from gay people on gay issues, that a week later they would say, this is an outrage and you're ignoring us. How much attention do you need paid? Well, when you tell everybody they're special, and everybody they're important, then everybody's going to expect to be pandered to. The Democrats have created this mess. I love watching this fall apart. I love seeing this come to a head. It's brilliant because it's the only way something like their electoral strategy could be. You notice they sort of have kicked out the blue-collar union workers. Why? Because they always have painted blue-collar people as, well, they're horrible racists, they're homophobes, they're so on and so forth. They think that they've replaced the blue-collar union workers. The unions, by the way, the union workers weren't really voting for them anyway, so they've given up on them. But even back then, it was even an even more disparate group. What will happen next when you've got Hispanic activist groups saying that you didn't pay enough attention to issues facing the Latinx community, or whatever the hell they're calling themselves, the activists are calling themselves, versus activists from the black community are saying, hey, wait a second, you used to pay a lot of attention to us, now you're paying less attention to us, and you're pandering to the Hispanics. Because people are told only identify with people who look like you, people who have your same sexual orientation, whatever it is, get into your Tupperware container and watch out, we'll protect you from everybody else. Well, if you're looking to your protector to protect you, and you notice that your protector is paying more attention to somebody else, because, wait a second, you told us that our very existence depends upon you protecting us, and you're now paying more attention to this other group. What gives? And they won't have a good answer for that. They'll try. Well, no. We're paying. It's like the boyfriend who's caught, you know, checking out the butt of the good looking woman who went up the other direction when you're walking with your girlfriend. Like, hey, wait a second. What's wrong with my butt? What are you doing? Sooner or later, that doesn't end well. It never ends well. I just want to watch it end. I hope it ends this time because I don't know how they can continue. I don't know how they can do this in good conscience, but I don't know how they can also continue this because it's just a mess. It's damaging to the country. And electorally, you might be able to string together a couple of electoral victories, but sooner or later, somebody is going to break. Some part of your coalition is going to fall apart because you not only turned your coalition members against Republicans, you've really turned them against other members of your own coalition. That'll never, ever end well. But Democrats don't think about the future. They don't think about the country. They think about the immediate. How can we win? What do we have to do to win? We'll get to the blow up at the White House in a bit. But there's a couple of other 2020 things that I want to focus on. Joe Biden is running for president. I don't know if you know that. It doesn't seem like it so much anymore, but he still is. Well, Barack Obama, his old partner in crime, has come out and made an endorsement, not in the U.S. election, but in the Canadian election. He took to his Twitter account, as so many politicians do, and he tweeted, quote, "I was proud to work with Justin Trudeau as president. He's a hard-working, effective leader who takes on big issues like climate change. The world needs his progressive leadership now, and I hope our neighbors to the north support him for another term." The Canadian election is coming up very soon here. Justin Trudeau, you gotta love that. He's so super-duper progressive. He's the guy who's been caught at least three times in blackface, at least one time in full black body. He's wearing shorts, and he blacked up his legs and his arms and his hands, and he's super-duper progressive. Super. Now, he didn't do this when he was a teenager, when he was in his reckless youth days. He did this in his late 20s. Now, Justin Trudeau is the son of the former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. Why I know about Canadian politics is because I grew up across the river from it. I was always keeping an eye on those polite bastards. I knew they were up to something across the river. But Justin Trudeau did not have a normal upbringing. He's a lot like I imagine kids of celebrities are and kids of the super rich are, where they have this insulated life. And so reality doesn't creep in. What would have occurred to somebody at 18 not being a good idea, not a good thing to do, you probably shouldn't do that. At 29, you're still doing because why? Because you've been a child of immense privilege, not because of your skin color, but because of your luck of your birth. So this is the guy who Barack Obama decides to endorse. Meanwhile, Joe Biden is over there twiddling his thumbs, whittling away, going, you know, Barack, I don't know if you know me or not, but it would be nice if maybe, just maybe, you throw Uncle Joe a bone. Now, allegedly, well, it wasn't allegedly, he actually said it, but Joe Biden allegedly claims to have told Barack Obama that he didn't want him to endorse him in the primary. He wanted to win it fair and square. That was, of course, back when things were going better for Joe, long before anybody started paying attention to what he was saying, listening to his lunacy. Now that things aren't going so well, you would think that, I don't know, President Obama could throw Joe a bone. He doesn't have to come out and endorse him. I get why a former president doesn't want to endorse in a primary, especially in a large field. You carry a lot of sway, and then if that person loses, you look bad. And if somebody you don't endorse ends up winning the nomination, it's going to make it really awkward when you speak at the convention, telling everybody, this is the person, you got to support this person, when you didn't support that person. So in that sense, it makes sense. Plus, former presidents tend to want the party to make their own decisions. They work behind the scenes, by the way. All of them do. But that's why Barack Obama hasn't really spoken out and endorsed anybody yet. Particularly, one would assume it would be Joe Biden, but then who the hell knows? That doesn't mean that Barack Obama couldn't say a couple of nice things about Joe Biden. Joe Biden's been taking hits after hit after hit for quite a while now. There could be, especially on the Ukraine thing, if Joe Biden was doing Barack Obama's bidding in Ukraine that just so happened to help his son, Barack Obama could come out and say that and say, hey, look, there was nothing corrupt about it. Joe Biden was doing what I told him to do. He hasn't said it. He hasn't said anything about Joe Biden is the greatest. He's a wonderful sidekick, a great wingman, wonderful, whatever it was. He didn't say any of that stuff. And he hasn't said any of that stuff. It doesn't have to be an endorsement, but it could be kind of a pressure release for Joe and say, hey, you know, Joe's a good guy. Maybe he jumbles his words every once in a while, but he is right there and he knows his stuff. And still, there's nothing like that coming from the Obama Twitter account. Instead, he's endorsing Blackface McGee north of the border as a super duper uber progressive. If only Virginia didn't have term limits on their governors, maybe Barack Obama would have endorsed Ralph Northam as well. I mean, just complete the blackface set. Also, bad news for the Biden campaign. He is number four, I think. You know, he's in fifth place in cash on hand when it comes to Democrats running for president this time. He's raised a ton of money, but he spent a ton of money and nearly $923,000 worth have gone to private jets. One out of every $16 his campaign raised during the last quarter. Biden spent $923,000 on private jets during the third quarter. That's just the third quarter, according to Federal Election Commission records on the campaign. This, he also, by the way, after being asked whether or not, hey, that's not super duper green, Joe. You're Mr. Green Jeans out there. You're out there talking about how we got to basically surrender our economic liberty to the government in the name of the environment, and you're out there flying private to the tune of $1 million over the course of 3 months. What gives? Well, they also spent a bunch of money on buying carbon offsets, which are the biggest scam in the history of the world. I love these rich liberal elitists live their lives. They're not willing to change their life. What they're willing to do is they cut a check, and they cut a check to these dubious organizations or third world countries, and they say, I'm going to fly private, so here's some money, go plant a tree for me. Or I'm going to expand my house. I'm going to add another 5,000 square feet to my mansion and a nice, huge air conditioner to it. Here's a check. Make sure you don't get air conditioning, okay? As long as you keep not having air conditioning, we'll balance each other out. You know, you don't build 15 houses that add up to a total of 5,000 square feet. And if you do build them, you don't get any air conditioning in them. And we'll call it even. I'll build 5,000 new square feet off my mansion, and we'll have it nice and toasty, like 67 degrees. And we'll call it even, and I'll be able to sleep at night not feeling like a raging hypocrite. Well, you are a raging hypocrite. All of these people are raging hypocrites. There's no way to verify. Oh, I planted a tree. Did you really? Yeah, sure, totally. I did. Absolutely planted a tree. Okay, well, one tree or a couple of trees, you really have to plant a forest if you're buying into the left's talking points about how dangerous to the planet and damaging to the world flying private is, or flying just in general. Now imagine just flying private. And Joe Biden ain't hopping on a propeller plane. When my boss in 2006 was running for re-election, and I was out in Montana, Montana's a gigantic state, and he would fly occasionally from one city to another because he's got campaign events, and we went and picked up Bob Dole from the airport one time, and they were rolling around in private planes. Notice I didn't say private jets like Joe Biden's campaign is. Private planes. A private plane was a four-seater. This is like the thing that Buddy Holly died in. And Conrad once said, you want to come with me up to this? I'm like, hell no, I'm not getting in that wind-up toy. I will drive there, and I will miss the event, but I'll see you in the morning. There's no way in hell I'm getting on that plane. Those things are still not free. but they don't have the carbon footprint as a private jet, and they don't cost nearly as much as a private jet. So Biden's campaign is seemingly being horribly mismanaged on top of having a candidate that is not doing all that well. Biden has $9 million in the bank. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren, $26 million, and Bernie Sanders, $33 million. Mayor Pete with $23 million. You got to ask yourself, where in the hell is all Joe Biden's money going? Well, private jets is one place. Okay, I've put it off long enough. Let's get to this ridiculous story, the outrage of the day, the showdown at the White House. Oh my goodness, can you believe what happened? Donald Trump had the Democrats storming out of the White House, leaving in a fit of rage. CNBC has the story. Democratic congressional leaders said they walked out of a White House meeting Wednesday on Syria after what White House House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called a meltdown. Now, who had the meltdown? To my mind, the person who runs out tends to have had the meltdown. There's a picture that Donald Trump tweeted out. Nancy Pelosi made it her wallpaper photograph on Twitter, because we're governed by a bunch of children, of Nancy Pelosi standing up in the cabinet room and pointing across, looking like she's going, here's what you got to do, Mr. President, like she's lecturing the president. Remember, 5 years ago, whatever it was, Jan Brewer was governor of Arizona. And Barack Obama flew out to Arizona, and at the airport, Jan Brewer met Barack Obama there. Because, you know, if the president's coming to town, it doesn't matter what party person is, you generally will take an opportunity to talk directly with them. Even if it's a Democrat, Republican, Democrat, it's not very often that you get a face-to-face chance to talk to the president of the United States. So you take it, because even if you're the opposite party, your state has important business at the federal level, or there are regulatory issues or whatever. And if you can grab 5 or 10 minutes of the president's time to pitch your case over what are the couple most important issues in your state that the federal government can alleviate, you take it. Well, Jan Brewer was out there, and there was a picture taken of Jan Brewer pointing her finger at Barack Obama in exactly the same pose as Nancy Pelosi, kind of the lecturing thing. And you don't really know what's happening in either one of these things, because a photograph just captures an instant in time. If you're sitting there at the table and your eyes are closed because you're blinking, somebody can say, aha, you were sleeping. I mean, it's not particularly useful, the photograph itself, but the reaction to the photograph is very, very telling. Because if you remember when Jan Brewer met with Barack Obama and pointed her finger at him on the tarmac at that airport, the reaction to that was one of complete outrage. She was called racist. You don't lecture the president of the United States. You don't point your finger at the president of the United States like that. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi does the same thing, and the left is cheering her as some sort of feminist hero. She's such a strong woman. She's such a brilliant woman. Well, for my money, strong women don't gather their pearls and run out of the White House. They don't storm away in a huff, in a fit, after being called a third-rate politician. The strong women that I know can handle themselves. But of course, handling yourself doesn't provide the political theater you're trying to get when you're trying to make an emotional appeal, when you're trying to just keep your base riled up. That's really what happened at the White House. There's a lot more, including Democrats going up to a microphone after leaving the White House. They were so upset that they ran right to the media, the warm, comforting arms of the media. And I'll tell you about that in a second. But first, our other sponsor. We're just over a year away from Election Day 2020, the most important election in American history. This election will determine if America continues down the path of greatness or if America will spiral down into full-blown socialism at the hands of left-wing radicals who clutch their pearls and run out of the White House. But we can't sit back and wait for 2020. You need to take action now. Text the word DAILY to 88022 and receive official Trump alerts directly to your phone. You'll gain exclusive 2020 updates right from President Trump himself. Be the first to know when your new Trump merchandise is available. You'll also be able to give your input on key issues to help shape the 2020 campaign. Again, all you have to do is text the word DAILY to 88022. If the Democrats take back the White House, they will destroy the booming economy with strangling regulations. They will continue to prioritize illegal aliens over the safety of you and your family, and the wall will never get finished. You can't let that happen. You can't let them undo everything you've worked so hard for. Make sure you're getting your news directly from the source by texting the word DAILY to 88022. That's the word DAILY to 88022. This was paid for by the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, a joint fundraising committee authorized by and composed of Donald J. Trump for President and the Republican National Committee that is dedicated to making America great again. The story from CNBC after top Democrats left the bipartisan meeting with Trump, Pelosi told reporters that the president appeared, quote, shaken up by a House vote condemning his decision to remove U.S. forces from northern Syria. The House approved the resolution in an overwhelming 354-60 vote, even as a majority of Trump's Republicans supported it. Quote, that's why we couldn't continue in the meeting, because he was just not relating to the reality of it. There is no reality of it. A resolution is irrelevant. It's, hey, this is what we want you to do. But the president of the United States is in charge of our foreign policy. I love how these leftists are now suddenly warmongers. We need to get back in there. We need to keep fighting in Syria. Okay, for how long? What do we have to do? Maybe stop attacking the military. Maybe stop tying, reining in out of control domestic spending to cuts in the military, like the Democrats did with the sequester. If you care so much about the military, how about you care for the military? You know, the military at this point is going, please, Democrats, stop caring for us. You screw us over every time you care for us. They want this endless war. Republicans and Democrats do. I don't support this. I've had enough. There comes a point, and yes, the Kurds have been allies. If you want to sell military equipment or give military equipment or whatever to the Kurds, I'm down with the cause. I'm right there with you. Let's help them out. Let's arm them to the teeth so that Turkey and or Syria think twice or three times and maybe don't attack them. I'm down with that cause. But as far as what the left and the right on this issue, the people who are outraged on this, what they seem to want is essentially to use U.S. military personnel as human shields. We aren't fighting there. The Kurds are doing the fighting. God bless them for that. But we have advisors embedded in with the Kurdish troops. Their hands are tied when Turkey allegedly fired near some U.S. troops last week. They were not able to return fire because the rules of engagement didn't allow it. This is why I don't want the military there. If you want to send the military back in there and you say, you know what? Here's your objective. Go do it. All right. Let us know what you need to do it. We'll set up a supply chain. You'll have everything at your disposal. You will have all you need to do what you need to do. Go do it. And I would be fine with it. But instead, we put these ridiculous rules on them, the rules of engagement. Well, if there's any civilians in the zip code, we can't possibly fire on anybody at all, any hostiles at all. Well, what do? The hostiles, the terrorists, what do? They strap kids to themselves. They surround themselves with children. And that is better than any body armor, because if a U.S. soldier were to shoot at them, they would possibly face court-martial and jail time. It's insane. If all our troops are going to be over there in this situation with Turkey and the Kurds in Syria is human shields just designed to try and keep the peace, and a peace that is probably not going to be kept because history exists and we know what the history is amongst the people in this region, and particularly these different ethnic groups. It's insane, and I want them out of there. But if you want to send them in and say, here you go, clear out this 20 square miles, kill anything that gets in your way, no prisoners, we don't want it, then I'm down with it. Go ahead and do it. I think we should arm the Kurds, we should support the Kurds, but we shouldn't be there unless we're actually going to be there to fight. So that's where the president seems to be coming from. Anyway, that wasn't, well, the blow up was kind of over that. As soon as this, the president called Nancy Pelosi a third-rate politician. That is allegedly when Nancy Pelosi said she had had enough. And she gathered up her belongings and she stormed out of the office, and the Democratic Party leadership followed her as if it were scripted, and it probably was, stormed out right to the waiting bank of microphones and adoring reporters. And here's just a little snippet of the statement to the press that these Democrats gave.
The witness on the part of the president was a meltdown. Sad to say.
Speaker Pelosi, did the impeachment
inquiry... No, it didn't come up. It did not come up. Not at all. No, it did not come up. It did not come up.
When he called you a communist, can you just elaborate?
No, he didn't call us, no, he did not call us a communist. He said... Yes.
He said, let's just clarify that. He said the communists... are taking or
some of ISIS were communists,
and you would be happy.
That might make you happy.
That might make you happy.
And the speaker said, yes, we walked out.
Yeah. At that point?
Yeah. No, at the point that he was.
When he started calling Speaker Pelosi a third-rate politician.
Which I said, I wish you were a politician, Mr. President, then you would know the art of the possible.
Did the Republicans stay behind? Did the Republicans stay?
Yes, some of the other members on both sides stayed behind. They wanted questions. I waited a moment because I wanted
questions.
To ask him the question about intelligence reports on the Turks and Syrians guarding ISIS, which I think is crucial.
It's important to remember that Barack Obama sat by and did whatever he did, filled out his March Madness brackets, while Syria devolved into chaos. He did nothing. He drew the red line, and then Assad crossed the red line, used chemical weapons, and then Barack Obama spent the rest of his administration painting over the red line, saying, what red line? There was a red line here? I don't even know. At some point, these countries, these people, this region has to stand on its own or have it out. That's my philosophy, okay? We're dealing with hundreds, if not thousands, of years of ethnic and political strife that we are not going to solve unless we are willing to essentially locate military bases there and just keep our people there again as human shields. And Americans will be picked off slowly, one or two at a time, and maybe there'll be another terrorist attack like there was in Beirut, Lebanon in the early 80s. And it will just be that forever. But we will then maintain the status quo or whatever over there. These people, just like in Afghanistan, and I've made this case recently, have to learn to stand on their own. Now, could the president have managed our withdrawal a little bit better? Yes, of course he could have. But so what? We should have had a withdrawal. Sooner or later, we need to sit back and let people figure their own stuff out. And if that means that they go to war, as horrible as war is, we can't afford to use our military as human shields to try to prevent war everywhere in the world. Because if we withdrew today, we withdrew next year, we withdrew in 20 years, the ethnic strife would still exist. Use the example of Afghanistan or the example of Iraq. The Shia, the Sunni, the Kurds, they were all under the iron boot of Saddam Hussein. So they weren't fighting each other as they had been for centuries in that region. Saddam Hussein, their common enemy, is taken out. And they did not go, oh, thank God, we finally now have a chance to be free. They said, all right, now we can go and settle those scores that have been around since our existence. Well, sometimes you just got to let that happen. You got to let that play out. You're never going to be able to convince somebody to logically talk somebody out of their bigotry and their hatred, and especially when it's handed down generation to generation. They're just going to have to come to terms with it themselves. It's horrible, it's sad, but it's part of human nature. And if it means that people have to go through some horrible things, then people have to go through some horrible things. What we've shown in the in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Syria, in this area of Turkey, is what can be. What can be. But we can't do it for you. And if you choose that what can be isn't what you want to be, that's on you. That's not on us. That's my two cents on it. But I do love the fact that President Trump called her a third-rate politician. And I love they walked out because they called her a third-rate politician. And how dare the president say such a horrible thing to such a wonderful, strong Speaker of the House who, upon being called a fairly innocuous name, grabs everything and runs out. Not a particularly strong woman. Now, just to give it context, these are the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, to a lesser extent, Steny Hoyer, although Steny Hoyer does it, he just doesn't get the press, who have engaged in and overseen their membership call Donald Trump every name you possibly can imagine. He's Hitler, he's a Nazi, he's building concentration camps, he stole the election, he is a Russian puppet, he is a traitor to this country, he has committed felonies while in office, he is a tax cheat, he is a monster, he must be destroyed. And Donald Trump says back, one time in one meeting, you are a third-rate politician, and why, that's beyond the pale. How dare Donald Trump speak that way to the leader of a co-equal branch of government? What the hell have Democrats been doing? What the hell have Democrats been doing on the watch of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi? 10,000 times worse than anything that was said in that meeting about Nancy Pelosi by President Trump. And the second she gets a small dose of her own medicine, she runs away. Like they always talk about the potency of fentanyl. Just one little grain of fentanyl could wipe out all of Iowa or something like that. Well, one little tiny little dose, a splash of your own medicine, causes Democrats to immediately flee the White House in outrage to the welcoming and warm and loving arms of the press gathered outside. Forgive me if I don't care. I don't want war anywhere in the world. But I also know that the United States can't live and exist and use our military to prevent war everywhere in the world, because there's a lot of places in the world where there are horrible things going on and wars going on. Are we going to deploy everywhere? If members of Congress are so very concerned, then go over there. Volunteer. They're a little bit old, but they just need bodies. Why not do it? If keeping our military over there is a way to prevent Turkey from invading Syria or whatever, then having a couple of members of Congress, particularly Democratic leaders in Congress, hanging out in northern Syria surely would prevent that, right? I mean, if you're willing to do that to our troops, essentially you can't fire on anybody unless it's absolutely necessary, then you could do the same. If you're going to use the military as human shields, as stopgap measures, then just get over there and do it yourself. They won't. They shouldn't. And I really hate that argument. I hate the chicken hawk argument that the left routinely makes, but I'm just sick of the constant state of war. Democrats, it's kind of funny, during the Bush administration, nonstop, end this war. Stop endless wars. George W. Bush is a warmonger. He's a horrible, horrible person. And then Barack Obama gets elected and the anti-war movement disappeared. It literally disappeared. We bombed more countries. Barack Obama bombed more countries than any president ever has. And the anti-war movement said what? The anti-war left said what? The very same people who interviewed Cindy Sheehan every second of every day they could possibly get with her suddenly took out their cell phones and deleted her number when Barack Obama got elected president. Now the anti-war left was back under Donald Trump, and now they're gone again. Which is it? Where are they? What do they really believe? What do we owe other people around the world? And for how long do we owe it? Can anybody answer that? Nobody's even asking that, except for the president. And he's acting on it. So in that sense, Democrats, sorry, just buzz off. And I mean that in the meanest possible way. It's just so, it's so damn boring. It's so hypocritical. Oh, he's talking this way about a co-equal branch of government. How have you been talking about? You're conducting impeachment inquiries in private, in secret, behind closed doors. You're denying Republicans the ability to ask questions. You're denying Republicans access to transcripts. You're denying the American people access to transcripts. If you're so damn proud of what you're doing, and if the evidence is really on your side and right there for you, the world needs to see it. Show it to me. I'm perfectly willing to accept it if you prove it to me. I'm willing to accept anything if you prove it to me. They aren't trying to prove it to anybody because they know they can't. The Washington Examiner had a story about how Kurt Volker, the former special envoy to Ukraine, was up on Capitol Hill the other day, and they got their hands on some of the transcripts, part of the exchange, where Adam Schiff is trying to badger Volker into saying there was a quid pro quo. Volker unambiguously said, no, there was no quid pro quo here. You find information, you investigate Joe Biden, or else you're not going to get the military aid, because Ukraine didn't know anything about the military aid being withheld until a month after. But that didn't stop Adam Schiff from going back and forth and back and forth, demanding Volker say something that wasn't true, to the point that finally Schiff had had enough and ended his questioning. He stopped in a huff. He was outraged. At this point, Schiff gave up. Why was Volker resisting? Quote, this is Schiff. Ambassador, I find it remarkable as a career diplomat that you have difficulty acknowledging that when Ukraine learned that their aid had been suspended for unknown reasons, that this wouldn't have additional urgency to a request by the President of the United States. I find that remarkable. Well, because the issue had been dropped and long since forgotten by then, Congressman Schiff. As Volker said, quote, they became aware later, but I don't believe they were aware at the time, so there was no leverage implied. You can't really use something as leverage if the other side doesn't know it exists. The Democrats' pseudo-impeachment case has no legs, has no anything behind it, which is why it's being conducted in secret. Which is why Nancy Pelosi won't hold an impeachment vote, which is why Nancy Pelosi is running out of the White House saying the president is unhinged. I find the person running away, screeching to the press about how unhinged the other person was, to be the person who is really, really unhinged. Speaking of unhinged, as we wrap it up here for this Thursday, Nicole Wallace, I just want to give an example. The Washington Free Beacon cut together this montage. Nicole Wallace is ostensibly the conservative over at MSNBC, which doesn't mean much. She is a former Bush administration official. She worked on the McCain campaign, so she's got a real resume of failure. But she's mildly attractive, so they put her on television and gave her her own show in the afternoon on MSNBC. She recently left her husband of more than a decade for a New York Times reporter, so she's a really lovely person on top of everything else. Listen to how the Republican over at MSNBC, Nicole Wallace, speaks about the Democratic candidates. Now, there's a ding in between, and what happens on the screen with the ding is the name of a candidate, but she says the names of candidates. The only one she doesn't say is Pete Buttigieg, who she speaks about first in this clip, and then she goes through various candidates. Listen to the glowing, drooling, slobbering way the Republican on MSNBC talks about Democrats running for president.
This guy is chicken soup for my soul. That guy there, that guy makes me feel better.
He speaks the language of sort of the faith community in a beautiful and eloquent way.
What do we know about Joe Biden?
Everyone loves Joe Biden.
Elizabeth Warner is that human being who is smarter asleep on Ambien than he is awake, jacked up on coffee. Kamala Harris is just that woman that he couldn't even get to look at her. She's beautiful. Yeah. She's brilliant. Yeah. She's a badass. Yeah. She's stronger than him.
We've been talking about Beto since the midterms. I think he is incredibly promising. It's clear that you have that thing that not all politicians had. Play media critic. What can we do better as those of us trying to cover your candidacy? That's what it looked like to me as someone rooting for your rooting for everybody. Where people were excited about all 20 people that they've seen over the last two nights, I think just about everybody helped themselves in some way. And my position is I will vote for the nominee's vehicle. I mean, whoever y'all settle on, you know, I'm in.
There you have the Republican at MSNBC slobbering all over candidates. She basically, I mean, if I were her boyfriend that she left her husband for at the New York Times, I'd be a little worried about her ending up in an elevator with Beto O'Rourke, the slobbering that was going on there. Maybe even Mayor Pete, although Pete probably wouldn't be interested, but she just slobbered. Oh, well, Beto, what can we do? How can we cover you better? How can I cover you better, Beto? Can I cover you? People wonder why the American public despise the media, because her show is presented as a straight news show. Yeah, that's straight news these days. Anyway, that is all the time we have. We're going to take our things and run out to the banks of microphones and tell the press how you have offended us greatly by calling us a third-rate podcast host. It's an outrage and a threat to a co-equal branch of America. How dare you? How dare you? You can email me, Derek at dailycaller.com. Don't forget the Patreon website if you care to support the show is patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast. You can email me if you got something you want to ask Greg Jarrett. Otherwise, we're going to have the Greg Jarrett interview for you on the show tomorrow. And once the show tomorrow posts, then you can enter to win the signed Greg Jarrett books. The same rules will apply. If you bought it already, send me a screen capture of you with the book, or a picture of you with the book, or a screen capture of your receipt or whatever, and you'll be entered twice. So there you go. It's Thursday. It's almost Friday, and Lord knows we could all use weekend. It's a coming. We'll see you tomorrow.
Play media critic. What can we do better as those of us trying to cover your candidacy?